Trail Mix.
Critical Camp.
From Kessel Barton.
On the Lizard.
In Cornwall.
The summer of 2016.
At Kessel Barton, Rural Centre for the Contemporary Art, artist Paul Chaney led Critical Camps. This is part one of a series of six broadcasts based on these workshop talks and happenings with invited artists, thinkers and scientists recorded on the Lizard Peninsula in Cornwall.
Here we are. Thanks for coming. And the apocalypse in my project wasn't ever really described. It's kind of like a ground to provide the impetus for change.
Lizard Exit Plan. Strategic plan for the survival of the peninsula's population based on topographical and agricultural data. An inventory of local resources. Analysis of defence requirements. Lizard Exit Plan discusses alternative futures. Experimental architectural interventions. Gastronomic experiences. Blueprinted maps. A 72-page instructional document.
Because, you know, when thinking about radical change and thinking about dealing with the various crises which we're facing as humans, humans are creatures of necessity, and we tend not to do things unless we really have to. So this was the kind of the idea. So the Lizard Exit Plan was the project, and it was basically I looked at all of the resources on the Lizard to see if it was indeed possible for the population to survive here. And it is. It's quite a good place to be when the proverbial hits the fan. There's plenty of land here, low population, lots of fishing. You could actually feed the whole population of the Lizard. You could meet their protein requirement with crab and lobster alone, which is very nice. Can you actually make something completely new? Or do you always have to rely on something that's gone before? And so to sort of like look into that question, I invited Robin Mackay here. He's a philosopher and director of a publishing company called Urbanomic.
The identity of sound has not always been with us. It is in fact the result of a disentangling of sound from its carriers. For a long time, sound, air, and the soul cohabited in such promiscuity that they were sometimes fused in one and the same concept. Living, breathing, perceiving and movement were all made possible through the action of one unique fluid, the pneuma. The Greek term pneuma, literally breath, is ambiguous. It is found in Greek treatises of medicine, from antiquity and subsequently in Plato. Aristotle even makes it the vehicle of the soul. It was also central to Stoic doctrine before Christian Gnosis, inspired by ancient myths and drawing on Genesis, began to consider it as spirit itself. The pneuma, qua vital principle, is a fluid that encompasses speech, breath, and soul. Here, therefore, sound is a substance, albeit an impalpable one. It is not yet a wave transported through the air. The air does play a fundamental role in the theory of the pneuma, though. It moves along with sound. Or rather, breath sound moves and enters back into the body of the hearer, as Plato tells us in the Timaeus. We may in general assume sound to be a blow which passes through the ears and is transmitted by means of the air, the brain and the blood, to the soul. And that hearing is the vibration of this blow, which begins in the head and ends in the region of the liver. Extract from The Order of Sounds, A Sonorous Archipelago, by François J. Bonnet, published by Urbanomic.
We're going into the Encampment Supreme Pavilion,
Cheney's 2015
architectural fusion, post-consumer waste products, locally found natural elements.
Robin, over to you.
Thanks very much, Paul, for inviting me And yeah, it's really good to come and be a part of this series of events because, as Paul said, this kind of umbrella project under which they're happening, the Lizard Exit Plan, I've been involved at least with kind of discussing the concepts with Paul since the very beginning. And I remember very distinctly one particular conversation we had where we were talking about this apocalypse that would cut the lizard off and saying, you know, what kind of apocalypse is it? And essentially we decided it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't matter what the nature of this apocalypse or this event which isolates this small piece of land is. What's actually important is this function of distancing and of isolation. And the fact that you end up in a situation where the restrictions that you're placed under mean that you really have to think about what it means to be a society, what it means to be an individual. And that really linked with a line of research that I'd already started looking at to do with the island and the figure of the island in philosophy.
Thank you.
So one of the ways we first started talking about the Lizard Exit Plan project was also that you could approach it from both ways. That is to say, what Paul's obviously done is made this detailed plan for how you would prepare for this possible eventuality, how you would gather the materials you needed to survive, how you would stockpile food, looking at the different kind of technological, agricultural infrastructure resources that are here, and how they might be used. But we also talked about kind of approaching it from the other side, so that you'd have this voice from after the apocalypse, which didn't really have a very distinct idea of what went before. So enough time had passed that this free lizard state had been in existence, and that's all that anyone can remember, and they only have very kind of vague memories of the past. So immediately it starts to be about, on one hand, this absolute break, and on the other hand, the idea of a kind of continuity of memory, but a continuity which is somehow kind of ruptured or disturbed by some kind of unspecified event. And so when I started looking into the way in which islands have been used in philosophy as images, and of course in philosophy there's relatively few images or illustrative figures, and so the ones that do pop up over and over again, it's interesting to look at them and see, you know, why has this been a strong image which philosophers have used to describe what they're doing or what they want to do. And I realised that this device of the island was very much along the same lines to do with this kind of isolation, and through isolation thinking about how you would start from nothing, what it means to fall back on your own resources. And it's an interesting kind of melange of politics, philosophy, and what's kind of most interesting for me, myth as well. So the island has often been used as a narrative, and it's very much linked to, you know, we all know the myth of the flood, the myth of Atlantis, which I'll talk about in a minute.
Human beings have always been myth makers. Archaeologists have unearthed Neanderthal graves containing weapons, tools and the bones of a sacrificed animal, all of which suggest some kind of belief in a future world that was similar to their own. From a very early date, it appears that human beings were distinguished by their ability to have ideas that went beyond their everyday experience. We are meaning-seeking creatures. Dogs, as far as we know, do not agonize about the canine condition, worry about the plight of other dogs in other parts of the world, or try to see their lives from a different perspective. But human beings fall easily into despair, and from the very beginning we invented stories that enabled us to place our lives in a larger setting, that revealed an underlying pattern, and gave us a sense that, against all the depressing and chaotic evidence to the contrary, life had meaning and value.
So, what's interesting about the island is it appears right at the beginning of Western philosophy. And at that point, what's happening is philosophy is trying to define itself. And we're talking here about Plato, the kind of inception of Western philosophy, and what he's trying to do is define what it means to do philosophy, what it means to think, if you like, rationally. And it's very much defined in opposition to. So on one hand, he often defines it in opposition to opinion. It's not about the way you can influence people's opinions, because philosophy is about loving the truth, drawing out the truth. But he also defines it, at least implicitly, in opposition to myth. You know, philosophy is not about telling the story, it's not about reciting Homer, it's not about telling the things that you've been told, that your father was told, that your grandfather was told. It's about drawing out something new. And as is very often the case in philosophy, the concept of the island emerges here, and you can almost see everything that it will become right at this first moment. Everything's kind of there in a germinal form. The island is a kind of conceptual laboratory for transplanting stories into ideas and for transplanting ideas into stories. It's a way of imbuing concepts with a narrative and bringing ideas alive through. So in Plato's dialogue, the Timaeus, in the 3rd century BC, what we get there is the closest that you find in Plato to myth. So it's a kind of a creation myth, but it's a rationalized creation myth. So in the second part of the dialogue, he talks about how the demiurge drew out matter from chaos, how he divided it according to this very peculiar numerical formula, which no one has ever really understood. And it's quite strange for Plato because, as I said, what he's generally trying to do is to set out the arena of philosophy as something which isn't the same as myth, which isn't the same as opinion, which isn't the same as story. So Timaeus is close to a creation myth, and it's probably his strangest writing, and the one that people have had the most problems in understanding. And as I said, it exemplifies at this very early stage the function of the island and the way in which the island implies a complete break, but also a kind of ruptured continuity of memory. So this is the fable of the island of Atlantis. So this tale of Atlantis is reported by one of Socrates' friends as an ancient story that he heard from his grandfather, and his grandfather heard it from a friend of his great-grandfather called Solon, and Solon heard it from an Egyptian priest. So you've got then this immense effort to distance what's going to be said from present memory. And from anything that might belong to the cultural memory of the individuals present. So he sets this Atlantis at this immemorial distance from his audience, and therefore you could say it has a mythical status. So the story that the priest tells, and which is now recounted at generations and generations later, is that there was a war waged by the kingdom of Atlantis, the island kingdom of Atlantis, against Athens. Because as the priest tells Solon, the Nile has flooded many times and has saved the Egyptians and their knowledge from complete catastrophe and from being wiped out. And among the people who don't have the protection of the Nile are the Greeks, and the Greeks have been wiped out and destroyed many times over the long period of history. So in this way, Plato is giving his audience to understand that they belong to a very shallow level of memory, cut off from the deep past in which this story is taking place. And the Egyptian priest has this amazing phrase when he says, "You Greeks will never be anything but children." The story of Atlantis is kind of this crumb which is being passed down to them. And their people, as Plato tells us, disappeared into the depths of the sea. The island of Atlantis never reappeared, but Athens, of course, rose again from the water, but reborn into an immature state. So it was stripped of its former glory. It was once this incredible place, which is now just a state of children, a kind of infant city, which has to learn again to become the perfect republic. So there, Plato's kind of setting Socrates up and setting himself up in the role of the person who has to re-educate this society of children, this young society cut off from this immemorial past. And he's using a myth as a kind of an image to drive home to them, you know, we don't actually know what we're doing. So the Philosopher's Island, then, right at the beginning, is connected essentially with a mythical concept of time, with forgetting and with memory, and with re-beginning, with re-founding, with restarting again.
We have to talk about it. Midnight strikes.
To make one domestic announcement, that the compost toilet I've been slaving away on for the last 3 days is functioning, except for the door does not close and there's a plank missing on the door.
Contemporary kind of apocalyptic myths perform the same kind of function. They enable you to ask a question, you know, at the other extremity of time, to say, you know, if everything that we know is destroyed and we start again in this future time, then what is it that we're going to, how is society going to emerge? What is it that we are going to base this refounding of the world on? And that's precisely the question that Paul's project asks, I think.
contemporary apocalyptic fictions offer a complete break with the past, the prospect of an uncertain future, a laboratory to think about the present, from the flood to the desert island to the abandoned space station, depleted earth. Imagine starting again from nothing, reinterpret, rebuild, repurpose, the possibility of change, starting from zero, making the best of what's left, some salvaging our own.
So the island myth comes back over and over again in the history of philosophy. The kind of greatest flowering of it is in the 17th and 18th century. But what's quite interesting to look at is how in between classical civilization and the Renaissance, the memory of philosophy itself was born by the Islamic philosophers. And it's in the Arabic philosophers and commentators who nurtured and developed philosophical thought. And you find in a 12th century Arabic text called, in English it's called The Improvement of Human Reason, or The Self-Taught Philosopher. And it's known to have been influential for The Jungle Book, Robinson Crusoe, Tarzan. So all these kind of more modern narratives which are to do with, kind of reduction or regression to a savage state. And it involves this child who's cast away onto an unpopulated island and raised by gazelles. And the narrative follows the progress of this castaway's thinking as he becomes human, as he discovers the world in isolation from all human contact. So it's really a philosophical treatise which talks about all kinds of things, from biology to planetary motions to mathematics, in a progressive form that recounts how all these different kinds of reflections emerge spontaneously in this man who's been reduced to his natural state. He doesn't have any social interaction, he doesn't have any culture to draw on, he's completely on his own on this island, and he's growing up among animals. He discovers how to use his hands, he discovers how to make clothes, he discovers how to make tools and weapons. He, of course, discovers fire, cooked food, and gradually he begins to become aware of his difference from the animals, of his humanity. But the really pivotal moment is when his gazelle foster mother dies, and then he begins to reflect on what it means to be alive, what it is that's alive in an animal, and what happens when an animal dies. And so gradually this self-taught philosopher on the island, he rediscovers in effect all of Aristotle's philosophy, and this is quite important. So he's supposed to emerge gradually, this man who's completely isolated, but in fact what he rediscovers is what Aristotle had what had been handed down from Aristotle to the Arabic philosophers. He proceeds with an immense classification of everything on earth, animals and vegetables and minerals and inanimate objects. And then he begins to embark on kind of more properly philosophical reflection that, you know, all is one, is everything made out of the same substance, and more abstract questions and lofty conclusions. So this feral child raised by gazelles eventually kind of becomes an enlightened philosopher. And in fact, at the end, he does make contact with civilization again through the medium of a holy man who comes to visit the island. But he goes back to his fellow humans and he basically finds this so stupid and annoying that he decides to go back to his island again. the philosophical island always has to be about reinventing mythology in a new and interesting way. And in Crusoe, the mythical recreation of the world from the deserted island gives way to the reconstitution of everyday bourgeois life from a reserve of capital. In other words, you know, there's things that are smuggled into this supposedly natural, spontaneous development. He says Robinson's vision of the world resides exclusively in property. Nothing is invented. And he finishes off slightly harshly. One can hardly imagine a more boring novel, and it's sad to see children still reading it today. Any healthy reader would dream of seeing Friday eat Robinson. So, even despite these suspicions, of course, Robinson Crusoe has been rewritten in countless different ways, some inferior, some derivative, but also in many inventive and subversive ways. And my particular favourite is the 1972 novel by Michel Tournier, incidentally a friend of Gilles Deleuze, called Friday, or The Limbo of the Pacific. And I could really talk about this for hours because it's such a fascinating book, and I really do recommend it. But in short, the Robinson that Tournier gives us on the island, which is called Speranza, is depicted in the light of psychoanalysis and existentialism. So it kind of brings together Freud, Jung, the anthropologists, Levi-Strauss, and most importantly, I think, Sartre. And Tournier belonged to the generation in France, the post-war generation, where Sartre's being and nothingness was like this incredible intellectual explosion. And there's this very important part in being and nothingness where Sartre is talking about the other. The essential idea is that you can't just be a subject, you can't just be a person without the other. Your subjecthood, your sense of who you are and your sense of the world comes from your interaction with the other, and from the fact that when there are others there, you can imagine their point of view, therefore you can build a picture of the world. You know, the only way we can find out about the reality of the political is by doing this controlled experiment, by saying, if we had people who are completely unsocialized and we put them all together, how would society emerge, or would society emerge, and what kind of society would emerge? Would one person necessarily end up in control? Would there just be all-out war? What would happen? I am the island.
Suffered, I've never worked free.
there's never a pure beginning. There's never a starting again from nothing. There's never a repetition which is just going to produce the immemorial ideal state. You always smuggle something in. When you try to start from nothing, you always end up bringing something in with you. And so that's why I think this idea of salvage is actually truer to the concept of the philosophical concept of the island. It actually opens it up, because it's acknowledging that there are always remnants. You never start again from nothing. There's always this stuff lying around, and even when you're trying to find first principles and trying to think from the beginning, it's always a question of reconstruction.
Mm. Great. Thank you very much, Robin. Thank you. So, how are we doing for time?
Topics raised by Cheney's ongoing research project,
Lizard Exit Plan.
A speculative scenario in which an unspecified,
hypothetical,
apocalyptic
cuts off Cornwall's Lizard Peninsula
from the global economy.
The series of dinners are called The Last Suppers. So we started off with The Last Supper, and then we had the second Last Supper, and this one is the third Last Supper, and hopefully they'll go on and on. And the idea is that, you know, the apocalypse never comes. Dom, please introduce for us the third Last Supper.
Thank you, Paul. So the third Last Supper is basically a lamb and spinach curry. A month or so ago, I noticed that all the sea spinach along the coastal fringes was really coming up quite nicely, actually. So I thought, well, there's lots of it. It's really in good condition now. I should harvest it and use it. I went about getting as much sea spinach as I could. It's actually still very good now. So sea spinach, also known as sea beet, the ancestor of all your beetroots and chards, essentially. Grows very well in the zone, the absolute liminal zone between the sort of rocky cliff edges and the pasture beyond. It's on that little fringe between that you find it, and it grows in abundance in some places. It does well because it's very tolerant to iodine, which other plants aren't. And it seems to grow best when it's not sort of competing with many other plants. Treat it like spinach, essentially. Try not to wash it. You might get the odd slug, but if you don't wash it, you'll capture all the really sort of salty sea flavour. you rinse it too much, you're not going to get so much of that. The lamb is sourced from Tregellis Farm, which is a National Trust farm. The farmhouse is on the edge of Lizard Village, and they've got a few hundred acres kind of between Lizard Village and Lizard Point, where they've got about 150 Hebridean ewes, small number of Dexters, and so I've got 3 kilos of dyed shoulder of lamb. So the sea spinach I gathered from within sort of sight of where the lamb was being reared. Okay, so they're English tomatoes, which are in abundance now, probably from heated greenhouses. Issues around that, of course. You can grow your own coriander in a hothouse, you can grow cumin, you can grow all those, many of the spices that classically associate with curries you can grow. So we, in any oncoming or post-apocalyptic scenario, it would be possible to grow them.
Still have a curry.
There's Cornish potatoes in mint from the garden.
This is Dom's exercise in sonic salvage.
And it's the nice thing about it is that because it responds, the sound will be the sound that's generated will be responding to the space that the equipment's in, right?
Yeah.
So it's like gathering ambient sounds from here and then creating feedback and generating things from that then feed back into it again.
Yeah.
So it's not, Dom has got no idea what it's going to actually sound like.
So
tell us what's
going to
happen with the microphones,
how it
functions.
So, this is quite a new thing. And I was kind of thinking about, like, kind of really old acid techno music.
Yeah.
And my kind of love of it. And it's basically just a load of bleeps. So, I was kind of thinking along the lines of what's the kind of most basic whistly, hummy bits and a kind of clangy bit. And I've got a little loop machine here just to ease things along and kind of add some sort of rhythm. But most of what you're hearing is either going to be feedback coming from these microphones and that speaker, which is kind of quite kind of broad range, and this, which is like some kind of weird home cinema thing that I've got given, that just does like the kind of sub-bass rumbles. It's kind of it, really. It's kind of improvised. It could be really nice and it could be really good, or I mean, I can't pretend it doesn't have the potential to fail really badly. So I'm not actively trying to piss everyone off, but it could. That's about it, really.
Hooray.
And if the battery holds up, I guess we go. Oh, and I've got to do and I haven't actually done a sound check, so it's like what happens is completely fresh. And what happens? We'll give it a go, eh?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Contemporary apocalyptic fictions offer a complete break with the past, the prospect of an uncertain future, a laboratory to think about the present. From the flood to the desert island to the abandoned space station, depleted earth. Imagine starting again from nothing. Reinterpret, rebuild, repurpose. The possibility of change. Starting from zero. Making the best of what's left. Some salvaging of our own. You've been listening to Critical Camps, a Trail Mix special produced by Bram Thomas Arnold, commissioned by Castlebar Rural Centre for the Contemporary Arts on the Lizard in Cornwall.